You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first of four podcasts on the emerging role of biologic treatments in the management of bullous pemphigoid, hosted by Med Learning Group. This series is geared towards dermatologists, primary care providers, geriatricians, and emergency medicine physicians to improve understanding of the diagnosis and treatment of bullous pemphigoid. My name is Surabhi Dangi Garamella, and I'll serve as the host for today's podcast. We will kick off this podcast series with a discussion on the prevalence of bullous pemphigoid, known risk factors, and diagnostic challenges. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce our program chair, Dr. Victoria Wirth, and our guest expert, Dr. Michael Passerstein. Welcome, Dr. Wirth and Dr. Passerstein, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. So I wanted to start with a case of bullous pemphigoid and just to highlight some of the issues on what we're going to be discussing, how these patients sometimes initially present, which might be to an emergency room, and sort of what happens downstream of all of that. So this patient that I'm going to discuss is a 73-year-old Caucasian female, history of bullous pemphigoid that was diagnosed in April of last year. She did have a biopsy, and it did show a subepidermal bulla with eosinophils, which is very typical of bullous pemphigoid. But having said that, you sometimes have to think about other conditions that can give you subepidermal bulla. There are quite a number of them. And so that's why the biopsy and subsequently getting other testing can be very helpful. It so happened that this patient didn't actually have a direct MN efflorescence, which is looking for antibodies in the skin, or an ELISA test, which is looking for antibodies in the blood. And so it's more or less the biopsy was used as a diagnosis, which is not really sufficient to be sure. The patient was treated with prednisone and then tapered off several months later. And after being off for 3 weeks, the lesions came back again, and then the patient was put back on prednisone at a slightly lower dose, 30 milligrams per day, and was being tapered down and was also on some doxycycline. So the main points about this patient are that she had hypertension and she also has COPD. So the current plan for treatment was to continue the doxycycline, the niacinamide, and then to start dupilumab with a loading dose followed by a standard dose that's being used right now for atopic dermatitis. This is off-label, and thus often that can be an issue for patients. So in terms of the prevalence of bullous pemphigoid, we see the incidence is about 2.4 to 20 cases per million per year. And it increases significantly with age. And so older people are much more likely to have bullous pemphigoid. The other issue is that the prevalence is probably on the order of between 50 and 100 cases per 100,000. So clearly there are lots of people that can have bullous pemphigoid in a given population. The risk factors for pemphigoid are older age, and also sometimes they can have certain medications that seem to be contributing, which can include the gliptins, which are often used for diabetes. And if somebody gets a new onset blisters in the setting of gliptins, you really do need to think it could be a drug-induced bullous pemphigoid. There are other drugs also that can be implicated, such as furosemide or hydrochlorothiazide, and there's really actually a long list. So it's good to go through the drugs of a patient who has bullous pemphigoid. And so for non-dermatologic physicians, it's just important, I think, to be aware that this is something that happens with the bullous pemphigoid. It can present just with itching or eczematous lesions or even urticarial lesions. And so there has to be sort of an index of suspicion that leads to subsequent workup. And there's also often comorbidities because these patients are older. They can be diabetic. They're hypertensive. This patient was hypertensive. And so there are a lot of things that can get in the way of treating these patients with what seems to be working. So the prognosis of bullous pemphigoid is really, I think, very much linked to the comorbidities. And clearly, patients who are older who need steroids are going to be more at risk of infections. The mortality rate is surprisingly high when a patient gets bullous pemphigoid. And in addition, there actually have been dementias and neurologic conditions associated with bullous pemphigoid. So there are a lot of these kinds of things to think about in terms of managing the patients. The pathophysiology is such that There are autoantibodies, namely Bowles pemphigoid. There are two different types of antibodies. It's BP180 and BP230. And what happens is you get antibodies against these subepidermal antigens, and that leads to separation of the in the area of the lamina lucida, which is underneath the basement membrane, leading to these blisters. And we also know that there are a lot of inflammatory cells that come in, namely, to some extent, eosinophils and other Th2 lymphocytes. And these are making certain cytokines that are really contributing to this whole inflammatory cascade. Complement can be activated, and you get to blisters. And so now that we understand a little bit about some of the cytokines that are made by the inflammatory cells, such as interleukin 4, 5, IL-31 causing itch, and IL-13, it's possible to think about, are there ways that we can more specifically target the disease? So I think in general, then we want to talk about how strategizing treatment. And as I said, often in the past, we've used steroids, which have many side effects. And sometimes we have to use a steroid-sparing agent, such as mycophenolate mofetil or methotrexate or azathioprine. If they're really severe, they may end up in an emergency room and with a lot of blisters. And we're lucky enough today to have Dr. Parserstein here, and he can sort of address some of these issues from the emergency room perspective. So welcome, Dr. Parserstein. I'd love to have you discuss a little bit more about this in terms of the presentation.
Yeah, thanks. I think it can be possibly intimidating for many emergency medicine clinicians to have a patient when you see the chief complaint of a rash. And when you evaluate them, if there is a diffuse blistering rash, as these blisters can be large. So they can range from 1 centimeter to 10 centimeter lesions that are tense and diffuse on trunk and extremities. So when we see a patient with this type of rash, it can be possibly intimidating, but I think hopefully at the end of today's podcast, we'll all feel a lot more comfortable in making the diagnosis and comfortable in the appropriate workup and treatment and plan for the patient.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's really does require, I mean, very often these patients will, they may be in a nursing home or they're elderly and they're not getting identified, and then they show up with, you know, really extreme disease, and it's really important to initiate treatment because it can otherwise become a really severe problem. And so I think the emergency room physician can often be on the front line for this, and it's important to realize that those patients have to be treated. We had talked a little bit about, and we'll talk about in the future, about kind of what the treatment paradigm is. So is there anything else that you wanted to bring up at this point?
Yeah, I think the emergency medicine approach shouldn't be any surprise to those of us that work in the emergency department, is first to figure out, is this a life-threatening or otherwise a major emergent rash that we cannot miss the diagnosis? Those rashes include Stevens-Johnson syndrome, leading to toxic epidermal necrolysis, staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome, disseminated herpes simplex or herpes zoster, and there are a few others that are cannot miss. When it comes to bullous pemphigoid, it should hopefully be pretty obvious that it's not one of those cannot miss life-threatening or otherwise immediate life-threatening diagnoses.
So you were talking about some of the differential diagnoses that can happen in the setting of Bowles pemphigoid. And so maybe you might want to touch a little bit on some of the symptoms that patients may come into the ER with and how you might evaluate them.
Sure. So Bowles pemphigoid is characterized by, or can be characterized by, intense pruritus that patients may also report a burning sensation. And sometimes that can be their initial complaint in the emergency department. I know I've seen many patients with just a chief complaint of itching all over And that can be challenging to figure out exactly what the cause is. Often we cannot. So one strategy might be to check labs to evaluate for renal disease, look for hepatic disease. But if there's no other lesions, then often, I imagine, it'll be unlikely to think of bullous pemphigoid from the beginning. So sometimes we just prescribe diphenhydramine to take care of the itch, but these patients will often return if it's something more sinister, such as bullous pemphigoid.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And in elderly patients, you know, we know there's so many things that can cause itch, you know, with just dry skin in the winter or even some kind of infestation. And it's just, it's very difficult sometimes. But I think it's just good to know that it's something to think about in a really refractory itchy patient. And then that brings me to wanting to talk a little bit more about treatment. And so this patient really, I think, helped exemplify how we might think about treatment. Often, if it's very limited disease, we might start with something like a topical steroid, like a clobetasol, as long as it's not on the face or in the groin or axilla. And this is actually in France. They've done some studies with total body clobetasol, not just on the lesions, which have led to less toxicity, less morbidity, and mortality, which is kind of interesting, but very difficult to apply in the United States because somebody has to be there to really help the patient be able to do that. So what we can say is that we often will divide patients into either mild or moderate severe disease. And mild might just be a few lesions or a few blisters. And in that situation, you know, you're going to want to document what's going on to know that what you're treating, but then we might only give them doxycycline and niacinamide, for instance, and that can take a month or two to work. We usually give 100 milligrams twice a day of the doxycycline, and niacinamide is 500 milligrams twice a day. But those kinds of approaches can be anti-inflammatory and enough in a very mild patient. And then combining that with lesional topical steroid can really kind of be fine. However, I think in the ER setting, you're probably often going to see people who have more widespread blisters, and they're going to require some kind of treatment with prednisone. And the typical starting dose for that would be 0.5 milligrams per kilo per day. And unlike what we might think about for poison ivy, we really have to maintain that dose for a period of time until the patient's no longer making new blisters and most of the lesions have healed. And at that point, when there's disease control, then you can start to think about slowly tapering the prednisone. And it's usually done over, you know, many weeks. So, and at the beginning, if they're above 40 milligrams a day, we might be tapering it by 10 milligrams each week or so. But after that, it's even slower, 5 milligrams per week between 40 and 20 milligrams. So now there's 40, 35, 30. So going down really slowly and even slower below 20, down by 2.5s, and below 10, down by 1 milligram in a week. And what can happen is the patients will flare if you try to taper too quickly. Then they have to go back up on the steroids. And that's really difficult for patients to have to live through. And the nice thing about a slow taper is you figure out what's the lowest dose that will control the disease. Now, some patients require a steroid sparing agent, and that can be azathioprine, methotrexate, mycophenolate. And these are all things that will be managed, hopefully, by a dermatologist who sees these patients after the diagnosis has been definitively made. And the therapies have gotten, you know, much more complex. We can sometimes use rituximab, which gets rid of the B cells that are making the pathogenic autoantibodies. And we combine that with sometimes occasionally IVIG to try to remove the antibodies that are already circulating because just turning off new antibody production is not sufficient. You want to get rid of antibodies that are already there. And so that combination of treatment can be really helpful. And what this patient really exemplified, though, is that there's now some targeted therapies that have been trialed, and one of them is dupilumab. And this one targets the IL-4, IL-13 part of the inflammatory process. And we know that these cytokines are made by Th2 lymphocytes. And so that this inhibits the action of these cytokines and can lead to improvement in the bolus pemphigoid. And there's been a trial recently of dupilumab for bolus pemphigoid that really did demonstrate a big difference between in terms of disease control and then being able to get off prednisone and stay off prednisone for a long period of time with the treatment of dupilumab versus a control. So I think that we are entering a new era of targeted therapy, and it's going to be very helpful to be able to have access to that in the future, hopefully. And so thank you very much for discussing this issue about the emergency room and how to approach these types of patients.
Thank you, Dr. Wirth and Dr. Passerstein. And thanks to all of you for joining. We hope you'll tune in to the remaining episodes of the series where we will hear more on the diagnosis of bullous pemphigoid, referral to dermatology, and the current and developing treatment options. This podcast was brought to you by the MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And thank you to our supporters, Sanofi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, for providing an educational grant for this activity. Have a wonderful day.